Well, friends, welcome back to the Space for Faith podcast. My name is Mike Goldsworthy, and I am so glad that you are hanging out with us today. We are continuing on in what we've been doing for the last several weeks now. We are reading through this book that was super meaningful and important for me and for so many others, called The Divine Conspiracy by Dallas Willard. And we're just kind of taking a chapter a week, and we're finding somebody that has been affected by the book as well to talk about a chapter with. And the way that I'm thinking about this is that it's kind of like if my friend and I had read this chapter and we were sitting down for a meal or a beer or a coffee, and then we were just kind of like talking about like what happened to us as we were reading this chapter, what were things that stood out to us, what did it stir in us, what did it make us think about or realize, and even like it takes us in some different directions. And so I'm really excited for us to have my friend Jason Miller coming to us all the way from South Bend back on the podcast. So Jason, welcome from the northern tundra.
It's not bad here right now. Thanks, man. It's good to be back with you.
And friends, I want you to know that like Jason and I, we had this is our third time trying to record this. That we had some technical difficulties on the first one. The second time, we literally were staying in a home together. We traveled and we were staying in an Airbnb together. I brought like portable stuff to record, and we were together for like 3 days, and we did not record anything. So
that's just how busy we were with other important things.
That is. That's how it goes. Well, Jay, we had you on recently, or maybe not recently now, it was last year. We had you on to talk about your newest book, which I guess is your only book also, but newest sounds, it sounds fancy.
Yeah, sounds fresh. Yeah.
When the World Breaks, but for folks who don't know you, I've read your bio before, but do you have like a way that you describe yourself for folks who aren't familiar with you and your work?
Sure. I'm a pastor who never really felt at home at church, and I'm still figuring that out. A lot of what I do looks like pastoring, but a lot of how I kind of identify feels more like art. And I love, that process, and I love being around that process, whether it's here in South Bend or other places. I'm 41 years old and trying to figure out, the passageway of middle life. And then I lead South Bend City Church, which is a great privilege of mine, a community here in South Bend. We've been around for about 8 years now, and we are together figuring that out.
And for folks who aren't paying attention to Jason, like you should be following him. Check out southbendcitychurch.com for their teaching and their podcast, and you will not be disappointed. But we want to get today into chapter 4 of The Divine Conspiracy, which is, Willard titles it, Who is Really Well Off? The Beatitudes. And a part of why I wanted to talk to you, Jason, about the Beatitudes chapter was because, like, you've done a lot of work on the Beatitudes, and it undergirds so much of your recent book and all of that. But before we get specifically into that chapter, I would love to hear your Willard origin story. Like, how did you first come across this book? Like, what did that look like for you?
Yeah, I remember, so I went to a Christian college for undergrad, and there were a few people who, like mentors or professors that I really genuinely looked up to, you know, like really good human beings who I'm like, man, if who they are and what they are working on is what Christian is, I'm in, you know, people who loved me really well and who had a lot of character. And then I remember that they were all abuzz about the fact that some guy was coming to campus to preach in chapel. And his name was Dallas Willard. And I hadn't heard of him at the time, but the clear respect that Willard had from these people who had my respect meant that I showed up in chapel that day, like really keen to get a glimpse of this person who apparently mattered so much to these people that I respected. And so in chapel that day, I was bored out of my mind. He was so boring. His delivery was, this is college chapel. We're used to like basically like slightly elevated like youth group speakers, you know? And then Willard comes in and he's just so chill and slow and kind of quiet. So at first I was like kind of confused. I was like, I don't get it. And then I'll never forget, a few days later, a couple of those people, so one of these people, I think, was a professor of mine in philosophy or religion. Another one of them was the resident director in the dorm where I was a resident as a student. A couple of days later, I was in the car with both of them, and we were going up to Grand Rapids to like go to some used bookstores because we were nerds like that, still am. And I'll never forget, Dave Slater, the resident director, was in the back seat reading out loud his notes from Willard's lecture from the chapel. But because Dave was a really thoughtful guy, and because he wasn't like blinded by the delivery from Willard, which is kind of chill, he really like pulled some gems out of Willard's talk that began like that. That I remember that car ride to Grand Rapids was the first time I was like, oh wow, there's something here that like I've not heard before, but it also doesn't feel like innovative. It feels like everything I have heard was pointing toward this, but I hadn't heard anybody say it, you know? So I remember that car ride being really transformative. And that's when I began to flirt with the Divine Conspiracy, meaning I bought it and tried it and got a little lost inside it, in its density. And then this is kind of fun because you just had him on the pod. But then a little bit later, like Aaron Nyquist was somebody who became a kind of a big brother and mentor of mine. And I knew this book meant so much to him, and that kind of brought me back to it. And so this would be early to mid 20s, a little bit after my regular college experience, where I first actually got my hands on this, and it began giving me like so many handles. It's almost like I'd been close enough to the good stuff, I'd been around actually hearing what Jesus had been saying in the Gospels, but not at the center of it, and not having it named this clearly and as compellingly. So when I finally got to this, it was like, this is what I'd hoped was there in the Gospel. This is what I'd hoped was there in the invitation, but was having a hard time locating it until this book came along. And then it traveled with me really well, I think, as I was trying to begin to figure out like my own adult life with faith, and then also working at churches and doing ministry. Like, what are we doing here? You know, what's our mission? And this book, I think, became the first like anchor that I could really pay attention to, that would ground me in moments of confusion around like what on earth we were doing as a church.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating because, mentioning Aaron, I think Aaron's a few years older than me, and then you're a few years younger than me. And it feels like we're in the kind of like window of folks who were really affected by this.
And then, like firsthand. And then there's the groups who were affected by the people who were affected by it, right?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask you about. I'm curious about, like, I mean, that would be, my guess is, like, largely your church are probably folks that didn't necessarily engage with this, but they're being affected by folks who had engaged with this.
Yeah.
Like, is there... I have been trying to figure out, like, what is the divine conspiracy of that generation, or is there one? Is it just simply there's this diaspora of those of us who've been affected not just by this, but that this book significantly played a role for a lot of us?
Yeah, no, it's funny. I don't know what it would be. You mean for people who are like a little bit younger than you and me?
Yeah.
It's funny, before you hit record, you and I were both talking a little bit about what it's like to reread this book today for you and me.
Yep.
And in different ways, we were both talking a little bit about, you know, what still resonates and what did resonate then, but that feels a little different today, or we have a different relationship to it. And as we were talking about that before you hit record, I was starting to think, I wonder when we're due for another one. You know what I mean? I wonder whose job it will be. And where we'll get it from, a kind of once in a generation statement about what the kingdom of God is and what the gospel invites us into. And maybe it's not even helpful to assume that there needs to be one thing that does for the next generation what this book did for ours. But yeah, my mind began searching in the same place that yours was, I think.
Yeah. I mean, this feels like a helpful plug for When the World Breaks by Jason Madden Miller, available where all fine books are sold.
I didn't want to say it. I'll let other people decide if I'm the next Dallas Willard.
Well, God, friends, in humility, we will have Jason move with us into chapter 4 here. And Willard starts the chapter off with these two questions that he's like, he's first and foremost a philosopher, right? And which I think is one of the things that for me is maybe why this book felt so fresh, because it wasn't somebody who's first and foremost a theologian. It was somebody who's first and foremost a philosopher. And he says that there's these two major questions that are always facing humanity that we're always asking. And it's first, what's the good life? Like, what's genuinely in my interest? And how do I enter into well-being? And who's a good person? And that these two questions are always sort of facing humanity. And he says the first question is what's the good life is being answered in the Beatitudes. And who's a good person is like the bulk of the rest of the sermon. Like when you started working through the Beatitudes and started like not just letting Willard affect the way that you're thinking about it, but you're drawing from a lot of different scholarship and experience in the way that you're drawing. Like, is that question, what's the good life? Do you feel like that is still a driving question that's underneath the Beatitudes?
That's interesting. I think today for me, there's a Venn diagram between the way rereading Willard's treatment of the Beatitudes, kind of a Venn diagram of overlap between the way I hear the Beatitudes today and then what he's doing in the book. But to me, the overlap has a lot. It's actually kind of buried a little bit later in the chapter where he, where first of all, he does a lot of, I think, really helpful work where he basically dismantles any idea of the Beatitudes becoming like a new virtue ladder that you climb.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really helpful to me. Like, for example, he says, a little bit into the chapter, he says, if all we need to be blessed in the kingdom of the heavens is to be humble-minded through recognizing our spiritual poverty, which is like if you take blessed are the poor in spirit and turn it into like a virtue prescription. So therefore become poor in spirit or know that you're poor. So he says, if all we need to do is to be humble-minded through recognizing our spiritual poverty, then let's just do that. And we've got bliss cornered. We escape the humiliation of spiritual incompetence because, strange to say, we've managed to turn it into a spiritual attainment just by acknowledging it. And we escape the embarrassment of receiving pure mercy, for our humble recognition makes blessedness somehow appropriate. That to me, like, is the big insight that cracked a lot of stuff open. That these Beatitudes weren't meant to just be like, well, this is the kind of person God blesses, so therefore become that kind of person. To me, that was like, yeah, that was the door that cracked open into a whole world of possibility about what these blessings might do.
Yeah. Can we hang out there for a minute? Because I know you're saying like a Venn diagram overlap. I don't want to lose that. But yeah, like that messed me up in so many ways. And one of the things that helped me to get there was when he moves to the Sermon on the Plain, Luke's version.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It's like, blessed are the poor, period. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst, period. It's and nobody has ever taught that I've ever heard Luke's version of this in a way where it's like, you should try to become hungry. You should try to become
right.
Poor, right? But I had always experienced the Beatitudes that way. And we had a program at our church that was really wonderful in a lot of ways called Celebrate Recovery, that like it was like it helped to normalize people's experiences of needing recovery in the church, and that the church space could like create room for that. And it was often like one of the more honest and authentic spaces in our church. But I always struggled because I would always say behind closed doors, but I'd say like, well, they bastardized the Beatitudes here. Because they turn the Beatitudes into 8 steps towards recovery.
Yeah.
Where it turns into this, like, here are the 8 things that you need to do in order to move towards a more authentic, whole kind of life. And, and the thing that, like, freed up for me in Willard's work of this was that, like, oh, this isn't about, like, you have to try really hard to become poor in spirit or to, like, somehow, like, you need to move towards becoming persecuted in order to, like, you don't, right? Like, it's not a move in that direction. It's like this recognition that the kingdom is present even here.
Yeah, I think another, a layer from the chapter that pushes that further even is he does that thing about how the Greek word for blessed, Makarios, would have referred to like the blissful existence of the Greek deities, that they experienced this suffering-free life. And I know it's tricky because Jesus wasn't speaking Greek, but whatever, we have the text. And I like how Willard draws your attention to the idea that like that word is so extreme in what it brings to mind, that when it's sat next to poverty within your spirit or the poor, or like, I think like he kind of amplified the absurdity in a really helpful way. That's another thing that helped me. He, these aren't like the absurd is the clue, right? That he's not just doing some straightforward prescription of, this is the behavior that elicits the blessing. Right. That helped me as well.
Yeah.
Like, something else is going on here.
Yeah. Like, how do you, because you are really gifted at being able to take something like that, that it's like, oh, this is actually really absurd in the text. This is really absurd in the way Jesus is delivering it. But we miss it because we're so familiar with it, because we, like, how, in what way, what kinds of comparisons, what sort of metaphors, what are you doing that helps that sort of absurdity, like, for us to sort of, like, make it a little more tangible for us?
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I had better, like, the only thing I've figured out how to do is to say that he's speaking in the language of paradox. I think it's important to like bring that category in for the Beatitudes. And I know a lot of us are kind of rediscovering the language of paradox right now. I think it's kind of having a moment, which is good. But paradox, to set two things side by side that are kind of fundamentally irreconcilable, that's like a clue, right? That's an indicator. Like, in your job isn't to try to like soften the edges of these two things so they fit. That's not how you deal with a paradox. You know, the way you deal with a paradox is you amplify the apparent contradiction until it forces you into a fundamentally new relationship with the thing that it's talking about. Matthew Fox is a theologian, and he says, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but he says, paradox is the language that we invented to speak of mystery. And I really like that. He doesn't say this, but I think it's like, well, poetry is the language we had to invent to speak of love, right? Like, it wouldn't work to use straightforward prose to describe love, and it wouldn't work to use straightforward prose to describe mystery. And again, then now we're back to the realm of like, whatever this is, it's not just like, well, here are the eight things that God likes, and so be those things and you're on your way, you know? And then the other thing I would say is like, then you begin to like set your own life experience next to these Beatitudes, and you look for a recognition, right? A kind of resonance between what you've been through and what he describes. And if you resist the urge to drag these Beatitudes into prescriptive stances and instead just let them speak, like let them stand on their own two feet and say whatever they want to say and be whatever they want to be as prophetic words. And then you kind of just set your own life beside them and just kind of see. It's almost like that, the magnet with the clippings, and there's a bunch of like metal things on the desk, and there's a magnet, and it only pulls out the things that are attracted to it, and the rest of the stuff stays on the ground. It's almost like your life has all this stuff inside it, and these Beatitudes are like magnets that if you really like sit with them, all of a sudden you begin to like know and name like your own poverty. Not that you're like performing it as a virtue, but that they begin to do that paradox work, and then there's like an invitation to just like sit with those things rather than run from them. Which now I feel like I'm actually going further than Willard goes.
Keep going.
Yeah. So for me, like I was talking to Kent Dobson on his podcast a little while ago about this. We were talking about my book and the Beatitudes, and we were talking about Willard. And I love that Willard like rescued the Beatitudes from the prescriptive moralizing thing that we do with them. So to me, that was like the first liberating move. But then I think I actually wish he would have gone a little further because today, at least for me, and maybe that's just a way of saying I wish he would have done what I do with him. but yeah, I'm like, there is like blessing does have to bless something is to a real blessing works on you. It acts on you. And I don't think it's meant to coerce you into becoming poor. I think it's meant to help you consent to the poverty you already have that we run from. And so when I set my life next to these Beatitudes, I'm like, poverty and grief, and the kind of bridled way that systems and circumstances rob me of my power, and the kind of aching for things to be made right within me or in the world around me, that hunger and thirst, like those are experiences I have known, and they're the things I most often run from, cover up, medicate, and I don't mean like good psychiatric medicine. I mean like Netflix or booze or junk food or Five Guys or what, like you name it, right? Because these are these things that I run from, because I think I want to grasp the sort of counterfeit existence of the gods, the false vision of the life of the gods, which is immune from those things. And the blessing says, actually, what if you could just abide those things? You don't have to perform them. You don't have to do anything with them. You just consent to them. And then what if that consent is the threshold that you cross into the good life that he describes throughout the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, right? That like, that enemy love and non-anxious presence and a refusal to exploit other people. What if these stances are made possible only on the other side of us consenting to the experience that we have within us that we are all running from? That's kind of where I take what Willard made possible for me, and then found myself moving in a few new directions.
Yeah, that's super fascinating. And I was, I saw Chuck DeGroat put something out today. Do you follow Chuck at all?
I don't follow him, but I see him in my feed from time to time.
Yeah, he'll pop up for me sometimes. And he's done a lot of work on like narcissism in the church. And he was saying something, maybe it was today or maybe it was recently, about like folks will ask him like, hey, how do we create like the mechanisms for church to like help protect it against abuse and things like that? And he says, I don't think that's actually the move. The first move is having safety within yourself to be able to show up wholly and fully. And it was this interesting move, I thought, where it was like, it's not about like these external mechanisms. So some of what I was hearing you say within this is like the move towards enemy love can almost be like a superficial religiosity sort of move that you do where you say the right cliche kinds of words, unless there's this other thing that's happened in you first, which is what's happening in the Beatitudes.
I think so. I think you can, I mean, I think we can, in a really kind of heroic and noble way, strive for the life that Jesus describes here, but that's different than this life flowing through us. And it's really tricky, right? Because I'm also a big fan of Willard's thing about grace is not opposed to effort, it's opposed to earning. And I do think you have to apply yourself. We're like, there's a lot of ways that I could be wrong about that, because I think you do have to apply yourself to this. But there's just something different, I think, when, here's another way of saying it. I think a lot of what Jesus describes in the Sermon on the Mount is a life that's fundamentally like responsive, but not reactive to everything broken around us, right? You know, to hate your enemy is to react, right? They come at you, you come at them. To love your enemy is to have a response to them, which is different than a reaction, because you're not reenacting their hate.
Okay.
And it's like, how do you dismantle the fundamentally reactive stance that we live with in relationship to our own wounds and our relationship struggles and all the violence in the world and all of our fears? How do you dismantle the reaction so that you can live in a kind of holy response? And I wonder if the effect of these blessings, especially the first four, is like, if you find out that actually all the grief that you're carrying, you don't have to be afraid of, right? If you find out that gnawing ache within you for things to be made right, that ache itself is in some strange way, the presence of God's righteousness, and God's justice, rather than purely the absence of it. Well, then you don't have to be so reactive and afraid of everything. So I see a kind of dismantling of these reactive energies happening if we trust these blessings, if we let them work on us. And then maybe it's that life that he then describes as one that's more possible to flow through us. At least that's the one thing I keep thinking about is these Beatitudes are the threshold you cross into the life he describes. A lot of Christians would say the Sermon on the Mount is the good life, like Willard says. But the question is like, what makes that life possible? And it's interesting that like the way Jesus gets us into that picture is through these very strange blessings, which makes me keep thinking there's something that these blessings do in us if we trust them.
Yeah.
Makes all that possible. But I don't mean you just, okay, well then I'll become poor in spirit, because that just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. It's the acknowledgement that there is a poverty within you that you, and you're consenting to the, that acknowledgement. Is that what I'm?
I think so. Yeah. And now again, because Willard says, blessed are those who know that they are poor in spirit is not the blessing. Mm-hmm. He calls that out, right? He's like, that's not what the thing says. And I think it's not, do you know you have a poverty within you? I think it's, have you consented to the poverty mm-hmm. within you? Those are two different things. I can know that I'm carrying around with me a poverty or a grief. That's different than consenting to it, you know, right? Like to stop trying to keep it at bay.
Yeah.
And instead to like live in a relationship with that poverty, with that grief, which is more than knowing that you have it, I think.
Okay. So you said earlier, you said at least the first four Beatitudes.
Yeah.
And Willard, like, I think he just kind of gives a little nod towards this. He doesn't spend much time on it, that some folks will see a turn that happens mm-hmm. in the Beatitudes. And he kind of seems dismissive of that, to say like, he reads them all through the same sort of lens. But I know a lot of folks don't read it in that way and see that there's this turn that happens. Like what do you think happens there? What is the differentiator?
Yeah, I was paying closer attention to that as he moves through. And he begins to sort of work out his reading of what's meant by the merciful. And he's trying to explain why his sort of theory of interpretation works consistently for all eight of these, right?
Which feels a little bit difficult on a few of them. I feel like
I was more struck by that this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That really stood out to me on this reading. I'm looking at it now. You know, his reading of the pure in heart is that they're the perfectionists, a pain to everyone, themselves most of all. In religion, they will find errors in your doctrine. He goes on, the peacemakers, I'm with him on the peacemakers thing. He says they're sort of out there in the middle on no team. It was hard for me to like work with his angle on that. Historically, and I've gotten this mostly from, the Beatitudes Through the Ages, by Eklund, I think was her last name. Great book on the reception history of the Beatitudes, came out a couple of years ago. And, her work calls out that, like, through a lot of the last 2,000 years, different interpreters have said the first four seem different from the second four. And what they think is going on between those two sets is different depending on who you ask. But there's a real consistent thread of people saying that blessing the poor in spirit, those who mourn, the meek, and those who hunger and thirst for righteousness or justice, that seems to be modally different than blessing the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, and the persecuted.
Because those ones seem more virtuous?
I think they seem like stances, right? They seem to name agency, I think, right? To be merciful, to be pure in heart, to be peacemaker. Those don't sound like passive stances to me. But poverty within you, to be grieving something, to have your power bridled by circumstances or systems, and to ache for things to be made right. Those feel like those things happen to you. But merciful and pure in heart and peacemaking, those things are things you do, is my take on those things.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Can I read you another little
please.
Critique that somebody offered me on this that I was super curious to get your take on? Mm. A mutual friend of ours is reading along, and he texted me this the other day, and he said, I just read Dallas's chapter on the Beatitudes, and it sounded a lot like Jesus was saying, Black Lives Matter, and Dallas kept saying, All Lives Matter.
Yeah. I think I had the same conversation with the same friend.
Okay. Yeah, he said, it seems that Dallas is doing important work to counter against the idea that we could create the conditions to be blessed, as if choosing to be poor would automatically bring God's favor. So he's rightly placing our hope back in God's grace, not in our worthiness. It's so important. However, it's hard to read Jesus' teaching or any of the prophets and not believe that being poor is a kingdom advantage over being rich. God's preferential leaning towards the poor and the oppressed, he puts Brueggemann in parentheses, and I felt like Dallas was discounting that and saying it was exclusively about our hearts. Of course it's about our hearts, but when my pockets are full, that forms my heart in a particular way. And when my pockets feel empty, that forms my heart in a particular way. The people who say all lives matter are literally more correct. Of course all lives matter, but the Black Lives Matter movement and possibly the Beatitudes are trying to do something really important.
Yeah, yeah. I've been thinking a lot about that. When I wrote my book, I was really debating what to do with Luke's version. So if listeners are not aware, if they haven't seen this, Luke and Matthew both have versions of these Beatitude blessings. But like Willard points out, in Luke, Jesus says, blessed are the poor, period. In Matthew, it's poor in spirit. In Luke, it's blessed are those who are hungry, thirsty, like just period. And in Matthew, hunger and thirst for righteousness or justice. So I really wrestled with that for quite a while. You know, there are those who would say that Luke's rendering is what Jesus actually said, and that whoever wrote Matthew's gospel came along and kind of spiritualized it, kind of did the thing that we criticize a lot right now, like in Western American churches. So I heard that critique. I'm really wrestling with it because I think the preferential option for the poor, which has a really substantial theological history, I think can mean a lot of different things. And I've read liberation theology. Gustavo Gutierrez is the founder of some of that. He's over here at Notre Dame these days. And I think there's so much to learn from that. But I have so many questions about what we mean when we say that. Are we saying that, you know, God is on the side of the poor over and against those who aren't? Are we saying that, for example, those who are materially poor, are less attached and less beholden to the things that prevent the rest of us from embracing the kingdom? And the answer to all that might be yes. I don't know. Like I can see different angles, but those are different ways of rendering that preferential option. I reread this chapter again after getting the same text from our friend. And I think I'm kind of like, I think I half see what he's saying. I'm not sure I'm all the way there. One more question about all that then is like, so it's one thing to ask, what do these Beatitudes mean for me individually? It's another thing to say, what do they mean for us collectively in the kind of world that we build and how we order our churches and where we put power and all of that? And what I just said is connected to that point too, because if... blessed are those who mourn. If that's speaking to me when I mourn, that's one place of application. But if that is helping me understand like how I should structure my ministry or our church so that we sort of center those who God is blessing, that's another implication. And I'm not sure that's bad to do. It's just a different, it's like a concentric circle of application. And so I feel like our friend there is, another way of saying it is that he's asking sort of questions about systemic implications of mm-hmm. these blessings. And Willard's really drilling down on the personal implications of these blessings. And I think a lot of me kind of just wants to say, like, I think the answer is yes. You know, that we need both, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so...
How are you thinking about that? You've had some time with that, too.
I feel all over the place on it, honestly. Mm-hmm. I think I understood what Willard's reading of the Beatitudes to be, that he essentially says, like, Jesus looks out, he sees a crowd of people, and he's picking out particular kinds of people in that crowd that he's using as illustrations. Yeah. So
that's his whole, what he calls it, the teaching method. What's that called? The look and see, or the concrete, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but
no,
yeah,
no, you're great.
It's right on nose. It's actually, his whole thing is that Jesus does his teaching like this. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so he's like, he's not necessarily saying like, oh, the poor in spirit is the quality that needs to live on in this beatitude forever and ever. He's saying, there are these people who are out in front of me who are poor in spirit, who are being discounted by the religious institutions as somehow less than. And Jesus is using them as an example to say, and the kingdom is available to them and blessings are theirs. And he's going around and he's picking them out. So I read Willard doing that, and that he's essentially like then using that as another example, using the rich ruler like as another example, as like that the prevailing idea at the time is that wealth indicated God's favor in your life, and he's trying to like move against that as opposed to like setting a setting that as not as an illustration or an example, but as a always idea. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Is another way of saying it, or alongside that, let me
you're going to take what I just said and make it clear for everybody, which I appreciate.
Well, so a couple of thoughts. One way of rendering this would be to say it's almost like you could add the word even the poor in spirit.
Yes.
As if to say the people who you think are least likely to be eligible for this, even they are in. So the implication of that reading is like, this is the most expansive inclusion, right? Another reading would be that, yeah, there are some people who are more eligible than this for this than others. But you just have the wrong people. You're right that there are people who are more eligible for this than other people, but you have the wrong people in the wrong categories. That's a different reading than saying, no, even the people you think are least eligible are in, which leans toward a kind of universal and expansive inclusion versus an inversion. And the tricky thing is, like, I think you can make a really good argument for either one of those. You know, the first shall be last and the last shall be first.
Yeah.
It's not just that even the last will be first. The first will be last. That's an inversion. That's not an expansion. So I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth. I think it's a really important question to ask about what we do with these.
Yeah, I feel all messed up in this. And you and I just came back from this gathering with a bunch of our friends out in Raleigh who are doing like really beautiful work around the country, around folks who are trying to reimagine the church and have a more expansive vision of the church. And there are so many folks that I got to sit under their teaching, whether it was like corporate teaching or just across the table, where I was learning from them. And I had these moments where I thought, like, gosh, in so much of the church experience that I've had, these are the folks who would be excluded. They wouldn't not only not be able to teach in front of a group of us, but they wouldn't, some of them wouldn't be allowed in some of the churches that I've been a part of in those spaces at all. And I had this moment where I was thinking about the what you were saying, that even them hearing Jesus say those words to, like, say, like, 25-year-old Mike, who would have never been sitting across the table to learn about theology and ways of engaging the scriptures and leadership from some of the people I was sitting across the table from, is this reminder of, like, yeah, that there's this, that the kingdom is working even in them, is what I would have needed to hear at 25. I think I probably need to hear something different now, or maybe it'd be a different group of people, but that was my experience of his reading of the Beatitudes.
Yeah, that's I think a really beautiful or a sort of flesh and blood example of what we're kind of kicking around here. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a lot of what I've got here. He moves it into a place where he's like, hey, there's Willard tries to make it a little bit more applicable, which I appreciate. Like, I always want to say, like, thanks for doing that, Dallas, but like that feels like somebody else's work there.
Yeah. He's a little outside his wheelhouse when he tries to do that.
Like, thanks for opening the door, and which was really helpful. But then he's got there's the silly side of the Beatitudes, and I was like, all right, I appreciate what you're doing here, but at least what it did for me is it like took the Beatitudes as examples and started getting me thinking about, like, okay, well, who would be some of those folks for me right now? Who would be some of those folks that would be like he talks about like the people who are having like damaging experiences of life. Like who are some of those folks and
yeah.
What does it mean that the blessing is available to them? Who are even like the hardest one I think is he moves to the immoral, the people who have done like horrific and terrible harm. And this for me still, like, I want to be able to like, I really appreciate that move towards like, what does it look like to call them blessed? That's where there's still like the biggest sticking point for me if I'm to like move that into some contemporary spaces and think about some of the people that are doing active harm and to think like, what does it mean to make that move there? That feels really difficult for me.
Yeah. I suppose I'm about to use words. I'm not really that. I feel like I'm not qualified to use these words. I think like when I say not qualified, I'm like, I don't really know entirely what we mean by this, but it's kind of like a non-dual invitation here, right?
Okay.
I think like that's back to these two readings, right? An inversion reading where in the first or last and last and for our first, there's still duality there. There's still, you know, binary categories of first and last and in and out and up and down and right and wrong. And then I know there's a lot of really thoughtful people who are kind of arguing, I think Cynthia Bourgeau maybe says that the Sermon on the Mount is a treatise in like non-dual thinking.
Hmm.
The way you really fully sort of, or that they're pitched at a higher level of consciousness. And that they're not going to make sense at this level of, you know, that we kind of live at one level of consciousness and that these words actually come to us from a higher level of consciousness, which is really hard because like then how are we supposed to, you know, work with them here? Maybe as you and I kind of like struggle with this together a little bit, another way of calling this out is I think when I was working on my book, I think what I realized was it's just so desperately tempting to want to like systematize all this stuff, mm-hmm. you know? So I really want my scheme to work where I've got the first four Beatitudes and the second four Beatitudes and kind of really fight with it to make it work inside that. And Willard clearly wants his scheme to work, you know, where each of these eight Beatitudes kind of fits into his sort of interpretation of what's happening. And I'm all for that, but like, I think it's a reminder that all of our interpretations are provisional at best, you know? And that at some point, like, I don't know, Jesus gets to mean whatever he meant. And then these words meet us and they do whatever they're going to do. And I think we're better off for having like wrestled with Willard. I mean, I'm certain we're better off for having wrestled with Willard, but I also, there comes a point where, like all of our equations kind of break down, I think. And I feel like maybe we've been bumping into a little bit of that here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so hard to like, I agree with you. And I don't know how to have the conversation that moves beyond the bumping up against that. Like, I feel like because words will automatically put us into that kind of a place. And I don't know how, like you, I feel like whenever I want to move beyond that sort of a place, it feels more of like a sense or like a guttural sort of feeling. And I don't
it's
have
not, the not language.
Yeah. I don't have the language to make sense of it.
Should we just grunt for a while? Should we just make some strange sounds for a while? Are we about to speak in tongues, Mike? Is that what's about to happen?
Maybe that is what's about to happen. And maybe that is even a way to be thinking about something like that. That I've been reading John O'Donohue's book lately, Anamkara, which I'd never read before.
Yeah.
And I have such a resonance with so much within Celtic spirituality. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I find myself constantly taking away anytime I read any kind of book on Celtic spirituality is that there's this searching for language to make sense of things that they keep bumping up against. And like he'll use poetry because he's a poet to try and do some of that. And I'll read the poems and I'm like, what the F is going on here? But there's something in the same way that you said, like when you first read Willard, that you're like that. It was almost like the, we'll use biblical language here. It's like deep speaks to deep, that it's like, there's something there that's like I that same sort of thing. And in the way that you're describing the Beatitudes, there's something about that resonates deeply. And yet I also feel like, when I'm trying to talk about this stuff, the only way I know how to put language around it wraps it up in some of the binary ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, I feel that too, man. That being said, like, it's been fun to, I mean, there is so much in rereading this that is regrounding for me. And like, I really feel that. And to be honest, if anything, I think, maybe not so much with this chapter, but with some of the other stuff that you've already been through and where you're going later. I'm even thankful, 'cause like, I do feel that Willard is like trying to wrap his arms around the whole, and, even the hard parts, even the parts that, are harder to swallow, you know? And I do think I'm certainly tempted to, having been sort of freed up from some of the heavy-handed, browbeating baggage of the world that I've perhaps come from, there's probably like some baby getting thrown out with the bathwater for me too, you know? And there, like, Jesus said some hard things, you know? And I think I trust Willard to confront me with that still, I think. And that's part of what's going on as I read through this. So I think that's probably good for me.
That's good. Is there anything in the chapter that you wanted to chat about that we didn't get to? Is there anything that I missed?
Man, here? I was trying to debate if I was going to bring this up or not.
Oh, now you have to. As soon as you say that. Okay.
Dude, this blew my mind, not in a great way. That's why I'm not trying to rag on Willard. I still think he's the man. He does this thing with Luke 4 that everybody gets wrong, and he got it wrong too. And this isn't like a matter of opinion. It's just like a plain reading of the text. So I'm just going to air this out for a second.
Okay? I'm so excited for this.
Do you know where I'm going?
I have no idea. No.
So Luke 4 is this famous passage in Luke's gospel where Jesus goes to his hometown of Nazareth, and he visits the Sabbath gathering, and they hand him the prophet Isaiah scroll. And he reads this passage that says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, for he's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to announce the captives are released, that the blind have their sight, that the oppressed are empowered," etc. And Willard's folding this moment into his beatitude argument, which is great. I'm all for that. But then he says, the response was violent. They tried to kill him because they understood clearly that he was claiming to be God's anointed leader, whereas they knew him only to be Joseph's son. Everybody I talk to about this passage thinks that's what happened. And because it's Willard, I'm like Mugatu and Zoolander. I was like, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. So I went back again and pulled every translation of the New Testament I have. I went to my Greek interlinear. That's not what happened. I don't know why people keep missing this. The text says, right after Jesus like folds up the scroll, and they're like on the edge of their seat, and they're like, what's Jesus going to say about this passage? And then he says, this is fulfilled in your hearing. And Willard is saying that that's what got them mad. But it's not what happened. He said, this is fulfilled in your hearing, which is audacious. It is saying that I am the fulfillment of these promises. It is audacious, but they love it. And every translation, including like my Greek interlinear, and I'm not good at Greek, it all says they all spoke well of him. And then said, isn't this Joseph's son? Which I take to mean like our guy is the hero. One, like hometown boy, like our guy is the guy, right? And the thing that sets them off is when he then says, but you're going to ask me for a miracle, and the only miracles you're going to get are like in the days of old when Elijah and Elisha perform miracles for Gentile outsiders. And then they try to kill him. And it's so important, I think. It's Luke's inaugural story of Jesus's ministry. It sets the entire trajectory of Luke and Acts, that basically says that wherever you draw your tribal line, following Jesus is going to require you to cross it. And like the arc of the entire kingdom transgresses those lines, and that's what got him in trouble. And it just blew my mind that he like glossed right over it. Not only did he gloss over it, he got it wrong. I was like, oh, buddy, come on, Dallas. I just keep bumping into it. I was talking to a buddy doing his PhD in theology the other day, and he was summarizing Luke 4, and he did the thing Willard did. And I just think, I get hot about it because we're living in a moment where, group boundaries are, you know, really, really energized right now. Right. And I mean that politically, I mean that religiously, and I mean that left and right and like in every direction. And, Luke seems to be saying, I think that like, it's the safety that we feel within those group boundaries that's going to prevent us from following Jesus. And I just think that progressives need to hear that and conservatives need to hear that. And it doesn't mean we don't talk about hard things, but So I was just really bummed to see that passage brought up and for that to be missed.
It's fascinating because it's like, well, one, it would have worked well, I feel like, into his move into the Beatitudes, right, to read it that way. It's also interesting of like, well, you bring up your buddy who's doing his PhD work, that like how much a prevailing idea gets into the water, and just a simple reading of the text allows us to see something different and and for the best of us. No, I appreciate you bringing that up. That's a good, it's a good word. It's a good reminder. It's a
my jaw dropped. I was like watching it in real time on the page. Like no, that Dallas, no.
I like how strongly you feel about this too. Where you're like, Dallas got it wrong. PhD friend, you got it wrong. Like you're gonna be walking around Notre Dame's campus trying to find some of the professors that are like, you're getting this wrong.
Because it just seems the thing we need so badly right now is that moment from Luke 4. You know, I think it it just feels really urgent right now.
It's really powerful. And the first time I recognized that switch was with you in Israel Palestine. We were in the Church of the Synagogue, and you taught through. We're right by the cliffs where
the hill. Yeah, where the hill would have thrown him off. Yeah.
So it's where he reads this passage, and then where they go to do that, and then and you reframing that like was so, it's just so powerful to recognize like, oh, the move against him is that he's trying to expand the boundaries of who belongs.
That's right.
Not that you have experienced any of that same sort of cliff throwing by expanding those boundaries.
It's a good warning for any religious person, right?
That's good.
What should we, the faith that should befall us, right?
Dude,
I'm glad you're doing this. I love that you're resurrecting this book for a lot of us right now. And in spite of like, I think it's good to be thoughtful and even critical. But in spite of that, I think it's like really super worthwhile to come back to this thing right now. So I'm glad you're doing it.
Thanks, man. Thanks for being here. Where can the folks find you who want to like call you a heretic after what you just said?
They can find me wandering the campus of Notre Dame screaming about Luke 4. No, I'm just kidding. JasonAdamMiller.com if you want to kind of track down my basic stuff. Instagram is the only social media that I'm active on, and I use the word active loosely. Jason Adam Miller on Instagram. If people want to follow my own preaching, but also that from others in our community, South Bend City Church on any podcast is a great place to track along with what's happening here in South Bend.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Thanks for making time. And I appreciate you so much.
Yeah, same, Mike. Thank you.